We are in Unit 3 now, which is traditionally the lowest performing unit in terms of the exam scores. I don't say that to discourage you. I say that to encourage you to be the first section I've ever had that has it be higher than Exam 1. It's a unit that has to do with two major themes, metabolism and energy. This first chapter is an overview of both of those, and then we'll follow that up with a chapter on glycolysis and cellular respiration, and then finally a chapter about photosynthesis. The opening slide here is a schematic representation of something that is called a biochemical pathway. You can see that there are reactions involved here. In this case, it's three reactions, but there's nothing special about three. A pathway is two or more chemical reactions, making it up. But what makes it a pathway, rather than just a random collection of reactions, is that it's a serial arrangement, an end-to-end arrangement of those reactions. Any individual reaction, as you already know, turns some reactant into some product, right? So there's an output for any given individual chemical reaction. A pathway, though, takes the product produced by the first reaction, uses it as a reactant, and turns it into something else in the second reaction, which then gets used as the reactant in the third, and so on for however many reactions we're talking about. And therefore, any given biochemical pathway, no matter how long, has an initial reactant that you start with, and then some final product, D in this case, whatever D represents. That's just what makes something a biochemical pathway. There's all kinds of different biochemical pathways, including the ones that make up glycolysis and cellular respiration and photosynthesis that we're going to look at the particulars of later. But and includes several other pathways as well. An important thing that I didn't mention so far about this is the enzymes that are shown here. Notice that there are three different enzymes, each corresponding to just one of the reactions that make up this pathway. In other words, enzymes are specific to a reaction. Each individual enzyme is specific for a particular reaction. That's true in general, whether a reaction stands by itself or is part of a pathway. Effectively, all of the chemical reactions that make up metabolism in an individual require the help of enzymes to make them happen quickly enough for life to be sustained. But this brings up an important point about enzymes, or catalysts in general. Enzymes are catalysts made out of protein. Any given enzyme speeds up a reaction, but is not a member of the reaction. It's not a reactant, it's not a product. And that's why an enzyme, the name of it, or enzyme 1 as an indicator, should never be written on either end of the arrow. That's where reactants go on one end and products on the other end. Enzyme names are always indicated above or below the arrow, to indicate that they are not actually reactants or products. They don't get turned into anything. After they've helped out a reaction, they emerge from that process just like they started, so they're reusable. Also, though, they shouldn't be written on either side of the arrows, because enzymes, or catalysts in general, are not required for reactions to occur. The reaction could happen without the help of the enzyme, but it's going to be much, much slower. And in the case of the reactions that make up metabolism in living things, in other words, it will be millions of times at least faster with the enzyme's help And therefore, without the enzyme's help, that reaction will happen so slowly that it effectively is turned off from the viewpoint of the cell. Now, there's two important components to this. Enzymes not only speed things up so those reactions can keep us alive, so that's one important thing, but it's also important that these reactions are so slow without the enzyme's help that they'll effectively be turned off, because that means the cell can control reactions and pathways made out of those reactions simply by controlling the enzymes. In other words, by deactivating an enzyme, a cell can switch off a reaction, because it'll be so slow without the enzyme's help that it just isn't going to happen. Now, there are three reactions here, so there are three different enzymes, but there would be one enzyme for each reaction. And so the general point there is what I've already said. Enzymes are specific. In other words, there isn't one master enzyme that works for all the reactions in your body, for instance, or in any individual. Like a master key would be a single key that could get in any lock within a big complex. Now, that would be a simpler situation, right? You'd only have to have one gene, the instructions for how to build that one protein, which would be the master enzyme, and work for all of your metabolic reactions. But what would be the problem with that? Why didn't that happen evolutionarily? Similar. Not necessarily having anything to do with being messed up. But if you had one master enzyme, that means all of your possible reactions would be running continuously. And you never want that to happen. There are pathways that are opposites of each other, for instance. You wouldn't want those to both be on at the same time. So by having specific enzymes for specific reactions, the cell can control what biochemical pathways are operating and which ones are not. And that's continuously changing depending on the current needs of the cell. All right, let's go to slide 2 then. Talk about energy. Energy is not an easy thing to define or really to conceptualize. It's not a material. Energy is often defined in textbooks as the capacity to do work, which is partially true, meaning no work can be performed without energy. That's energy drives work, which physically speaking, the physical definition of work is the movement of a mass. And that requires energy. But it's kind of an elusive thing. It's not something that you can look at. It has many forms too. Many forms, like electrical energy, chemical energy, light energy. These are all different forms of it. But what's represented here in this picture is that, regardless of form, there are two major categories of energy, which are potential energy. Anyone know the second? Kinetic energy, yes. Now, potential, just as a word, means having the capacity. I mean, if someone has potential, then that person could do something. Similarly with potential energy. It's often described in textbooks as stored energy, which means energy that's not currently performing any work, but is there and could be used. Kinetic energy, on the other hand, is energy of motion, energy that is being used. And speaking of motion, that's exactly what the K-I-N-E part of the word means. It's the same, even though it's spelled differently, same root as in cinema, which means moving pictures. So That's the difference between these two categories. But importantly, there is easy interconversion between the two. Kinetic energy can be converted into potential energy. Potential energy can be converted into kinetic energy. That's happening all the time in the universe, including in this little subset of the universe shown in the photograph. Right? You can spend kinetic energy moving uphill on these stairs. And when you do that, you are investing your body with greater and greater gravitational potential energy, farther you get from the surface. Right? So kinetic energy is being converted into potential energy in that case. And then if you jump off or fall off, the opposite happens. The potential energy that you invested your body with is now being converted into kinetic energy of you falling. So that's the interconversion aspect of the two. But the form, the actual forms, there's many. And mostly in this unit, we'll be talking about chemical energy, but not exclusively. Let's go to three, though, and talk a little bit about thermodynamics, which is a branch of science dealing with energy transactions and the performance of work. It's important in biology, but it's also important to a lot of things outside of biology. And before I get to the laws that really is the focus of this slide, let me just say that we'll be talking about what are called thermodynamic systems. Sometimes we just say system for short, but it's really thermodynamic system that we're talking about. A thermodynamic system can be anything you want it to be, really, as long as you define what it is. You have the universe. That's everything. That's the entire set. A system is simply some subset of the universe, a thermodynamic system. So it could be a chemical reaction. It could be your body. It could be a water bottle. Anything at all, as long as you say what it is, what is contained in that system. But when you define a thermodynamic system, you're really splitting the universe into two subsets that don't overlap. The system itself and everything else in the universe, which collectively is called the surroundings. All right? There are more than three categories of thermodynamic systems, but I'm only going to give you three in this course. And those are open systems, closed systems, and isolated systems. An open thermodynamic system is one that is able to exchange both energy and matter with the surroundings. A closed system can exchange energy with the surroundings, but not matter. And an isolated system can't exchange either energy or matter with the surroundings. In other words, it's cut off from the rest of the universe. Well, there's really no true thing as an isolated system, truly isolated. It's really just a mental construct to make it easier to talk about thermodynamics. There are some real systems that approximate an isolated system, but they're not truly isolated. For instance, when I said water bottle, if you have a Dewar, which is a laboratory version of what you would think of as a thermos, it is closed because nothing is going in or out of it, right? No matter is being exchanged. But it's not truly isolated because even though it is designed to minimize the exchange of energy with the environment, which is why the temperature stays either hot or cold in it, no matter what's happening outside, it's not perfect, right? You come back 10 years later and the soup is no longer hot. So there is exchange of energy. It's just very gradual. It would be closed but not isolated. Anyway, that's the distinction between those three. We'll get back to those a little bit later. But thermodynamics has laws, the laws of thermodynamics, as you see here. And there are four laws of thermodynamics, but we're only going to talk in this course about two because those have particular relevance to biology. And you might think that the four are called the first law, second law, third law, and fourth law. That's not true. The first law, second law, and third law existed. They put those down first, and then they realized we need something more basic before the first law, and they didn't want to renumber them because people already knew them as that. So the four laws are really the zeroth law, the first law, the second law, and the third. First and second are what we're going to talk about here. The first law of thermodynamics is often stated as the law of conservation of energy. Or we say that energy is conserved in the universe. That means, that's just another way of saying that the total amount of energy in the universe is constant. It doesn't go up or down. Energy can't be created or destroyed, this law says. But it can be transferred and transformed. Energy transformation refers to changing energy from one form into another. For example, this chemical energy of the food that this predator is eating is going to eventually be transformed into the energy of its motion as it's running. Or sunlight, which is radiant energy, gets converted into chemical energy when a photosynthetic organism like a plant produces the sugars driven by the energy of the light itself. That's transformation. Transferring energy just refers to moving the energy from one object or body to another. Striking the cue ball onto the rack of balls in pocket billiards is a good example, right? That energy of the motion of the cue ball gets transferred to the other balls. So that those kind of things are happening all the time in the universe. That's the first law. The second law has to do with the concept of entropy. Now, have you been taught anything about entropy in any of your courses? You heard this word? What does it mean? Right, entropy means disorder. Randomness, in a sense. And what the second law says, one of the things the second law tells us, is that the total entropy of the universe can only increase, not decrease. Which is kind of like saying that the whole universe is very gradually unwinding, becoming more random, becoming more disordered. The total entropy of the universe can only increase. Well, let me just, this is kind of an example of what I was just about to say. If you think back to the first day in here, the very first slide, I think, was when we looked at those seven things that living things have in common. One of those was a high degree of order, remember. So there are examples of subsets of the universe, or systems, that are highly ordered. Having high degree of order means very low entropy, because entropy means disorder, right? So it's not impossible, obviously, for entropy to decrease for a system, which is just a subset of the universe. That happens every time an organism is created, right? Because organisms have high order. But the only way that a little subset or a system within the universe can become more highly ordered, meaning entropy goes down, is at the expense of the surroundings. What I mean by that is that for something to become more ordered, everything else in the universe has to become even more disordered. And therefore, when you add the two up, the overall disorder of the universe is still increasing. All right? That's what happens with anything that is highly ordered, but that includes all organisms. Another important implication of the second law of thermodynamics is that in any energy transaction, which is what we'll be talking about a lot in this unit, but whether it's in biology or not, any energy transaction that happens, some of the usable energy that's available to do work gets lost as heat. So energy can be used to perform work. That's not heat. Heat is energy transfer without any work being done. And therefore, in a thermodynamic sense, heat is waste. It's waste energy because it doesn't perform any work. That doesn't mean that it's not valuable. It just means it's not performing work. It's valuable to us, for instance, because we are endothermic homeotherms. Homeotherms are animals that maintain a narrow range of body temperature despite whether it's hot or cold out. We do that, right? And the endothermic part of that means that the principal source of our heat is our own metabolism, rather than being heated up by the sun, for instance. It's our own metabolism producing that so-called waste heat that actually maintains our temperature. So, yeah, it's not performing work, but it's keeping us alive still. So don't think that by waste heat, I mean it doesn't have any value. It's just not thermodynamically performing any work. So another way of saying that any energy transaction has some energy lost as heat is to say that there is no such thing as a perfectly efficient energy transaction. If you consider an internal combustion engine, it's highly inefficient. You don't get even close to using all the available energy in the form of chemical energy in the gasoline to propel you down the road. Most of it is lost as heat, which is why the engine is not going to last more than a minute or so unless it has a dedicated cooling system just to keep from seizing up, because most of that energy goes just into heat transfer rather than work. And similarly, all of the metabolic reactions that make up life are to some degree inefficient. There's always heat lost. You never can use 100% of the available energy for work because of the second law. And you can see the waste heat coming off his back here in the figure. Okay, let's go to four now. Still talk about energy, but specifically, we're looking at what is called free energy, which has the symbol G. And the reason it's G is because even though we usually say just free energy, it's technically Gibbs free energy, named after Gibbs. That's where the G comes from. But G as a symbol by itself refers to the instantaneous value, meaning the value of free energy at the moment. in a system, however that system is defined. Free energy, though, is potential energy, meaning energy that could be used to do some work. Well, there are three example systems here. One is this diving platform that we just looked at. The middle one is a diffusion process, right? It's a gradient that's in place before. And the other one is a chemical reaction, specifically breaking something larger and more complex into smaller, less complex things. Each of those is a system, which can be anything, as I said, as long as you define it. But associated with each of these three systems is a process. So each of these systems is undergoing a process, which means there's a before condition and an after condition, top row and bottom row. All right, so it's something is happening, in other words. That's what I mean by a process. It's not just a snapshot in time. And in all three of these examples, there are therefore two different values of G. There's a G initial and a G final. Each of these three processes involves a change in the value of G from initial to final. And so G is valuable information in itself, but we're usually more concerned with delta G rather than G. The change in the value of free energy is delta G. For delta G, you have to have two conditions, right? Before and after. And just by convention, how are delta values computed? Delta G would be what? G final minus G initial. Exactly. Well, another thing that all three of these examples share is that the final value of G, the bottom condition, is lower than the initial value of G for the system. And therefore, mathematically, you're taking a smaller number, subtracting a larger number from it, that you're always going to get a negative number in that condition. And it's that sign of delta G, whether it's positive, negative, or zero, that is particularly important. If a process has a delta G that is negative associated with it, then that means free energy has gone down, right? It's decreased. The first law tells us that that energy is not destroyed. Therefore, it has to go somewhere. Namely, it is released from the system. So delta G tells you that energy is a negative delta G, tells you that energy is being released. But it also tells you that the system itself already had the energy required for that process to occur. And so, not only is energy released, but since the system had the energy necessary, that means a negative delta G is what's called a spontaneous process. Spontaneity is important because it tells you whether that process could occur on its own. A spontaneous process can occur because the energy required is built into the system. That's exactly what I told you, remember, in the lab when we talked about gradients. This middle system is a concentration gradient. A high concentration is associated with a higher value of of G than the condition of being spread out, diffused. This is lower G. So that's why diffusion happens. The energy required for that is already part of the system. It can happen on its own. In other words, it's spontaneous. Just like falling off of the platform can happen. Go downward if you fall off. And the breaking apart of the complex molecule can happen on its own because the energy required is there. But importantly, a negative G value only tells you that it is spontaneous and therefore could happen. That doesn't at all mean that it's going to happen anytime soon or at all. Just because something could happen doesn't mean it's going to happen. And it doesn't tell you at all how quickly it's going to happen if it does. It just says that it's energetically possible. On the other hand, each of these three things could be reversed. You can imagine them being reversed. It's never going to be possible for the diver to just fall uphill and go back onto the platform. Right? Because that would be an increase in G. The system wouldn't have the energy already. You would have to supply it to go from low to high. Similarly, these spread out molecules are never going to just on their own come together in a high concentration. And these smaller, less complex molecules are never going to build this bigger thing on their own because each of these would require energy input. Another thing about G values is that higher G values correspond to instability of the system. And that's why these processes are occurring. Things happen in the universe because that little subset of the universe is trying to attain a more stable energetic state by decreasing its free energy. And that's why the reverse of each of these will never happen. The reverse of these would all be non-spontaneous. You know that a process is non-spontaneous if it has a positive delta G. The reverse of all these would have a positive delta G, right? Because you're going from lower to higher G value. Non-spontaneous processes have to be forced to happen. Because the system doesn't have the energy, you have to supply it from the surroundings. Is that all clear? Okay, well then let's go to slide 5. Talk even more about energy. Let's notice first that these two graphs have the same exact axes. The x-axis is progress of the reaction, which is really time, right? So there's before and after the reaction in both of these. And free energy is on the y-axis. So any given value at one moment, any y value is g. There's two values of g, though, before and after. So you can compute a delta g. The delta g graphically corresponds to the distances between the two y values. And in the red graph, the system is at lower G value, has lower free energy associated with the products than with the reactants, and therefore mathematically the delta G is negative. So that tells you that it's spontaneous, as I said before, but it also even more directly tells you that energy is released. Because G goes down, that's energy. Well, it doesn't get destroyed. It gets released by the system. And therefore, a process that releases energy is called exergonic. Ergon in that word means energy. There is a unit of energy called the erg, but it means energy. Ex, as in exo, means out. The opposite of that is endergonic, which is shown by the blue graph. In this case, the system is the chemical reaction. That's how the system is defined. And the products have a higher G value than the reactants do in this case. So the delta G is positive. That's never going to happen on its own, right? Because it's non-spontaneous. But it also means for it to happen, energy has to be supplied. Energy is absorbed from the surroundings in order to cause this to happen. That's endergonic. Now, when we looked at that large complex molecule being broken into smaller ones in the previous slide, that reminds me to tell you that metabolism as an overall thing has two components to it. What is metabolism, though, first? It is, it's all of the chemical reactions occurring within one individual, whether it's one cell or many. And that's what life is, those chemical reactions. So that's the overall set. But you can break that down into two non-overlapping subsets. Catabolism is one of those.
Anabolism?
Right, and anabolism is the other. Cat means down, and means up. They're opposites. Catabolism refers to reactions that break larger, more complex things into smaller, less complex things. It's breaking things down. Anabolism is just the opposite. Building up things, building up more complex things out of less complex things. Both happen all the time. They're both required in cells. But that's the distinction between the two. Together, they make up overall metabolism. But we have three pairs of antonyms that we're dealing with here. Antonyms are opposite in meaning, right? Like up and down themselves are antonyms. So there's three different pairs of antonyms that are related to each other. One is catabolism and anabolism. Those are opposites. Another is spontaneous and non-spontaneous. And the third is exergonic, endergonic. They all describe different things, but they're related to each other. If you want to describe whether something is being broken down or built up, then you would choose either catabolic or anabolic to describe it. If you are trying to describe whether or not it could happen on its own, you would use either spontaneous or non-spontaneous to describe it. And if you're interested in saying what is happening to the energy, either going out or coming in, then you would use either exergonic or endergonic. But three of these correspond to each other. Catabolic reactions are exergonic and spontaneous. So catabolic, exergonic, and spontaneous correspond to each other, even though they describe slightly different things. The other three also correspond, but they're the opposites. Anabolic reactions are endergonic and therefore can't happen on their own, and they therefore are non-spontaneous. Is all of that clear? Well, like I said a little bit ago, living cells have all kinds of anabolic processes that have to occur for the cell to remain alive. Just one example would be building proteins, right? You have to build proteins because proteins do all the important things in cells. The proteins that you have in your cells are not the proteins that came from your food. You don't take proteins into your body. You digest proteins into amino acids. You take in the amino acids, and then you combine them in totally different ways to make your own proteins using the instructions in your genes. It's like dismantling a big Lego structure, but using the same bricks to build something completely new. Well, building that protein in your cells is an expensive process. It's endergonic, right? And therefore non-spontaneous, never going to happen on its own. You have to force it to happen. And the big point I'm trying to make here is that in any given organism, the anabolic processes that the cell has to perform are powered by energy that's released by catabolic processes that are also occurring in the cell. And the catabolic processes I'm specifically referring to are the breakdown or the use of, the burning of fuels. So when you think of food, there's two major components to food. Molecules that are going to be used as fuel to release energy, and molecules that are going to be used as building blocks to build big things out of small things in anabolic reactions. And the anabolic reactions have to have the energy come from somewhere. What powers them is energy released by the catabolism of fuels. But that's an indirect process. I'll explain what I mean in a couple more slides. But first, let's go to slide 6. I just earlier described the three categories of thermodynamic systems I want you to know about. This is a misprint by this book. This top one is not an isolated hydroelectric system. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to see the light, right? The fact that the light is shining means that energy is being transferred between system and surrounding. So it's not isolated, it's closed. That's what it should say. Closed hydroelectric system. It's closed, though, because no matter can get in or out. So the amount of water here is not changing. And at first, the water levels between the two tanks is different. Therefore, there's a gravitational gradient, right? Water wants to fall down, and the only place it can do that is through a tube that makes the water turn a turbine. That generates electricity, and that's why you see the light shining. But because it's closed, no water is coming in or leaving. And therefore, after some time, this will come to equilibrium, which is what a delta G of zero really represents. And when there's no more gradient, there is no more tendency for water to fall, just like there isn't when you're at the ground already. You're not going to fall off the ground, but it's a lot easier to fall off the diving platform. That's why you have a higher gravitational potential energy the higher you climb. Okay, so when that happens, no more electricity, the light bulb goes out. In the middle one, though, this is an open hydroelectric system because water is continuously being added at one end and drained off at the same rate at the other end. If the input and the output are both the same, then the gradient, the difference in levels between the tanks, will be maintained. And water will continuously be turning the turbine and the light will stay on. These are systems in their own right, but they're listed here in this biology chapter because they are, one of them, I should say, one of these top two, is more than the other like an organism. What are organisms like? Which of these two? Right. No organism, no living organism can ever be a closed system. In fact, I told you that in a different way before we talked about thermodynamics early on in the term. I said that any living organism has to continuously exchange materials and energy with the surroundings. Thermodynamically, by definition, that means every living organism is an open system. So we're definitely much more like this than we are at the top one. But it's an even better representation of what we are is shown on the bottom. This multi-step open system has the same overall gradient
beginning water level and ending water level is the same distance apart.
But in a multi-step system, water moves several turbines because a small gradient exists between each. In other words, energy is released a little bit at a time rather than all at once in one step. And that's how we use our fuels, as we'll talk about in the next chapter. Glucose is the master fuel, contains a lot of chemical energy, but we don't release it all in one step, in one chemical reaction. That would be an unmanageable and lethal release of heat, of energy. It would kill the cell. So instead, we do it a little step at a time. It's the overall change is the same, but by releasing a little bit of energy at each step, we can capture a lot of that energy and use that energy to produce molecules of ATP. And once those ATP molecules are created, they now contain the energy that used to be in the fuels. Some of it. Never all of it, because of the second law. There's always going to be some heat lost. Well, speaking of ATP, that's what we're looking at in slide 7. And just, well, what does ATP stand for, first of all? Right, adenosine triphosphate. So the three letters is really two words. And looking at the picture of it, what does ATP qualify as? What kind of molecule is this? What kind of molecule has a pentose sugar that is simultaneously connected to a nitrogenous base and a phosphate? A nucleotide. A nucleotide, yes. This is a nucleotide. ATP is a nucleotide. So ATP could be a building block for an RNA molecule, along with the other kinds of RNA nucleotides, right? You link them together. That's one of its uses. That's important in its own right, because RNA is important. But ATP has a completely different and really important side job, which is to store temporarily energy and then release that energy sometime later, usually very soon after it's stored to begin with. What a lot of textbooks will describe ATP as is the energy currency of the cell, by analogy with money, currency. Have you heard this definition? It is a good analogy. And that's because ATP is an energetic middleman, just like money is. What I mean by that is that almost no one, nowadays at least, works, puts in their effort for whatever job they perform, directly for the things that they need in their life. Right? You don't work directly for food or for housing, clothing, whatever. Instead, you work for money, which is the energetic middleman. Your effort, the work that you perform, which is energy, is put into the form of money. Money represents your effort. And then that money, once you have it, can be used to do a lot of different things, right? You can spend it a lot of different ways. It's versatile. And the same exact thing is true for ATP. In a cell, the energy released by catabolism, which is exergonic, is not directly used to power the endergonic anabolic reactions. There's a middleman involved, just like there is for money. So the energy released by catabolizing fuels, which releases energy, is captured by making ATP molecules, using the energy from the catabolic reactions to produce ATP molecules. That's like the currency. And just like money is versatile, ATP is really versatile, because it can then be spent to power any of a whole big number of anabolic processes that require that energy. So it's an indirect process between catabolic reactions and anabolic reactions, and exergonic and endergonic reactions. Is that clear?
Like you mentioned, with money, there's a middleman.
Yeah.
Would it be a middleman for ATP too?
ATP is the middleman. Money is the middleman. And using the money analogy, it's less useful to think of it as cash than it is to think of it as a debit card, which can change in value, right? A debit card can have a low balance or a high balance. Similarly, these energy-carrying nucleotides, one of which is ATP, can have high value or a higher energy or lower energy values. This is ATP, and I'll get back to what I was just saying, but first let me get through this naming thing. ATP is a nucleotide, but the word nucleotide is kind of vague, because the only requirements for being a nucleotide is that you have to have a nitrogenous base, a pentose, and at least one phosphate. So the word nucleotide doesn't tell you how many phosphates there are. And that's important for energy carrying capacity, because the energy that ATP is carrying, the useful energy, is in the bonds between the phosphate groups. But think back to when we talked about nucleotides. I told you that if you don't have any phosphates, you just have the sugar and the nitrogenous base, and that's it. What is that thing called? The nitrogenous base and the sugar bonded together as their own molecule would be what? That's called a nucleoside, with an S instead of a T. And there are different nucleosides, because there are different pentose sugars and different nitrogenous bases. If you have specifically ribose as the sugar, and specifically adenine as the nitrogenous base, then the nucleoside that those two just by themselves make is named after adenine. It's called adenosine. Adenosine is the nucleoside. If you then add phosphates to it, you can call it either adenosine triphosphate, which we're looking at here, or adenosine diphosphate if it has two, or adenosine monophosphate if it has just one phosphate. In other words, the word nucleotide doesn't tell you anything about the number of phosphates. ATP is better described as a nucleoside triphosphate. It's the same stuff, but nucleoside triphosphate as a phrase tells you specifically that it has three phosphates on it. And adenosine triphosphate is just a specific example of a nucleoside triphosphate, where the nucleoside itself is specifically adenosine. Is that all straight? All right, well, that is the usefulness as an energetic middleman of nucleoside phosphates. I say nucleoside phosphates to be intentionally general, because it can go from having three to two, or to one, back to two and three. These nucleotides exist as a huge pool in the cells of your body. You have quadrillions of nucleotides for the purpose of exchanging energy. But at any given moment, some fraction of the overall amount of the adenosine-based nucleotides is in the form of ATP, some fraction is ADP, and a much smaller fraction if you're not about to die, is AMP. And this is why the debit card analogy is better than cash. Because this is a high balance debit card, ATP, has a lot of energy usable. You use this thing by splitting the bond between the terminal phosphates. And so imagine this one leaving. That's going to leave you with ADP, which is like a debit card that is still useful but has a lower balance compared to ATP. So you could imagine if you had the ADP, you could then keep spending. Take another phosphate off of it, that's going to turn it into AMP. Well, that's getting emergency low balance on your debit card. And similarly in your cells, if a bunch of your adenosine nucleotides are in the form of AMP, that serves as a strong signal to the cell that you're using much more energy than you're supplying by burning fuel. So that will tell the cell, let's burn a lot more fuel so that we can turn those things back into ATP and keep powering your anabolic reactions. We see that in 8. We see the spending of an ATP in 8. ATP on the top. Like I said, spending it to do some work means cleaving off a phosphate. So in other words, to use an ATP is to dephosphorylate it, which means to remove a phosphate from. It's the opposite of phosphorylation. And the dephosphorylation of ATP, by looking at this figure, is what kind of reaction? Exactly. It's hydrolysis. That's why water is required. And when that happens, you have ADP, which of course has just two phosphates, but then you have a phosphate on its own, which is called an inorganic phosphate. Why is it inorganic? What is a phosphate group? What makes it up?
Oxygen, phosphorus.
Right, a phosphorus atom, four oxygen atoms, right? Importantly, P by itself means phosphorus. That's the element from the periodic table. That's the symbol from the periodic table. But when you have a circle around it, that does not mean phosphorus atom. That means a phosphate group. All the oxygens are there. It's just shorthand. So when you see the circle, realize that. The I subscript means inorganic. Well, all phosphates are the same, basically. But the phosphates that are still hooked to adenosine are part of an organic molecule because there's carbons in the adenosine. This one off on its own is no longer part of an organic molecule, and therefore it's termed inorganic phosphate. It just becomes part of the quadrillions of phosphates in your cells as the phosphate pool, and very soon after popping off of an ATP, it might be stuck onto another ADP to turn it into ATP. It's just continuously being reused, and for other purposes as well, but that's, don't think it's going to remain as inorganic phosphate for the rest of your life. Energy is coming out of this situation, though, because dehydrolysis of ATP is exergonic. That's why I said we're using ATP here. Well, the energy that comes out used to be energy that was in the fuel originally, right? This is why this is working as a middleman. The energy that it captured is stored in bonds between the terminal phosphates on ATP. Making that happen is the reverse of this reaction. It's shown one way, but it's a reversible reaction. You can force it to go the opposite direction. In other words, you can build an ATP molecule by hooking another phosphate, a third phosphate, onto an ADP molecule in the opposite of hydrolysis, which would be what? Dehydration, to produce ATP. So in addition to the debit card analogy, ATP, or the complex of ATP, ADP, and AMP, is like little batteries, rechargeable batteries. Right? You have to spend energy to charge them up. That comes from catabolic reactions and exergonic reactions. And then once they're charged, they can power other things, the anabolic reactions that are endergonic and require that energy. Okay. Let's see an example. Slide 9. Endergonic reactions, which are anabolic and non-spontaneous, and therefore never can happen on their own, can be forced to happen if they are coupled with exergonic reactions that supply the energy. I'm just basically repeating what I've been said already a couple times, but we see this now as an example. On the top, you have an endergonic reaction that the cell has to happen. And this is just one example. The example itself doesn't really matter, but you have glutamic acid, which is an amino acid, and ammonia being hooked together to form glutamine. And even though the delta G is listed here, you shouldn't have to even see its value to know that it's going to be positive, right? Because you're building up a bigger, more complex thing out of smaller ones. That's those three things that describe that or that go along with that are non-spontaneous, endergonic, and anabolic, right? Positive delta G never is going to happen for free. You have to force it to happen. The second row shows you that an ordinary glutamic acid can be energized by a phosphate coming from ATP. So you spend an ATP here, which means you pop off one of its phosphates, and that phosphate gets put onto glutamic acid to make a phosphorylated glutamic acid. Plus ADP is left over then, right? So this is phosphorylation of glutamic acid. And it's dephosphorylation of ATP. Phosphorylation happens for various reasons, but often when you phosphorylate something by adding that phosphate to it, you turn it into a more energetic version. So now in the third row, you have this higher energy version of glutamic acid, the phosphorylated version, reacting with ammonia to form the glutamine. And the phosphate gets popped off as inorganic phosphate. That's considering these two things as separate reactions. But I keep saying that exergonic reactions are coupled with endergonic reactions to force those endergonic reactions to occur. So if instead of thinking of it as two separate systems, it's now just one bigger thermodynamic system, the coupling of the two reactions. And that's where we can look at the balance sheet as far as energy values are concerned on the bottom here. This reaction is the endergonic reaction that's pictured in the top that you're trying to force happen. Glutamic acid and ammonia forming glutamine. That is endergonic. You can tell by looking at the delta G value. It's positive 3.4 kilocalories per mole. The bottom is the hydrolysis of ATP, which we've already said is exergonic. You can tell because it has a negative delta G, negative 7.3 kilocalories per mole. And if you combine those two into one coupled set of reactions, this bigger system, then that bigger system, the coupled set of reactions, has its own delta G, which is the sum of these two individual delta Gs, which, as you can see, comes out to still being negative. And that's why it happens, because the combined coupling of these as its own system is now exergonic, has a negative delta G value. You can see here that hydrolysis of ATP has more than enough energy to drive the anabolic, because 7.3 kilocalories per mole is released. The endergonic reaction needs 3.4 kilocalories per mole. What if you had a different endergonic process that required exactly 7.3 kilocalories per mole? Would ATP do the job? ATP releases 7.3. If you had a process that requires 7.3, would that be enough? I'm hearing both. Yes or no? If this is a different process that had a delta G of positive 7.3, would ATP be able to power that? Why are you saying no? Well, that means negative just means that this releases 7.3. This requires 7.3, I'm saying. But it's still ATP would not be enough. Why is that? Well, zero delta G is a special case. That is true. But why does that make it impossible? What does the second law tell us? Right. We always lose some energy as heat. Heat can't do work. So if it's exactly the amount that it needs, you're not going to get all of that out of ATP. Some of it's lost as heat, and it therefore would not be enough. So in other words, the exergonic reaction that's part of the couple needs to be more exergonic than the endergonic one is endergonic. The absolute value of the exergonic one has to be higher than the absolute value of the endergonic one for the sum of them to still be negative. Okay, let's go to 10. This slide shows you in cartoon form the two major categories of cellular work that can be performed by ATP. Now, I just said that ATP, using ATP, is going to involve some loss of heat. Heat does not work for you. Doesn't perform work, I mean. But a lot of that energy that's released can be harnessed to do work. And there are these two major categories. Transport work that's listed here would be better described as transmembrane transport, meaning transport of things either into the cell or out of the cell through the membrane using transport proteins. That's what the figures are showing. Now, you wouldn't need ATP to do all transmembrane transport, right? Because sometimes a gradient will be the source of energy. That's what we call diffusion. Here, though, we're creating a gradient. We're moving things against their gradient, so that's going to require energy, in this case in the form of ATP. The other major category is mechanical work, which refers to moving things around from place to place within the cell along these microtubules that we talked about involving these little motor proteins that move one step at a time along the microtubule. Well, each individual step requires a fresh ATP molecule. So it's expensive to do work. That's the point. That's what ATP supplies, that energy, but indirectly. The ATP is not created unless you use the energy from fuels to create the ATP to begin with. That's also shown in slide 11. I've said this in words already several times, but you can see the ATP middleman role here. ATP ADP as a, you know, it's going back and forth between ATP, ADP all the time. But what allows for the formation of ATP, which is the creation of ATP, the phosphorylation of ADP to make ATP, is an expensive process. That energy is supplied by burning fuels, which is the exergonic catabolic reaction that's the original source. And then that ATP, once it's formed, can quickly, usually it's ATP doesn't hang around very long, it's going to be used right away to power some endergonic process in the cell. And that's going to turn it back into ADP and inorganic phosphate, and that will be recharged again by burning more fuel. It's always going back and forth. But like I said, none of these is AMP, because when you have a good matching because of homeostasis between your energy demands and your energy burning, then it will just be going back and forth mostly between ATP and ADP. If you aren't burning enough fuel, like when you first start to sprint, your body thinks you're still sitting. So you're using a lot more energy than you're producing in that case, and that's when a bunch of these ADPs would then be turned into AMP, and that'll tell your body, get going. We'd burn a lot more fuel because we have to replenish these AMPs. 12. This looks very familiar. I mean, it looks just like a slide we looked at already in the macromolecules chapter. We have sucrose at the top, table sugar, a disaccharide made out of glucose and fructose that are being split apart in this reaction. So that's a hydrolysis reaction. That should all be reviewed at this point. The only thing that's new here is what's in violet highlight here, which is sucrase. Sucrase is the enzyme's name. And enzyme names often end in ASE. Not always, but often. And so if you see a word that ends in ASE in biology, it's usually the name for an enzyme. Not only do they have the ASE ending often, but the rest of the name tells you something about them too. They can be named either for the substrate that they are specific for. And remember, substrate is just the reactant in a catalyzed reaction. It's the thing that binds to the enzyme to get turned into product. Or they can be named for what they do, the process that they perform. For instance, there are dehydrogenases. They're called that because they're enzymes that help dehydrogenate. This one, though, is named for its substrate, which is sucrose, the sugar. Sucrase is the specific enzyme that allows for this breaking the glycosidic linkage, which is what the hydrolysis is performing. And it's the same point I made at the beginning of the chapter, namely that enzymes are specific for just a particular kind of reaction. And that's important because the cell can then control individual reactions by controlling the enzyme itself. That's a good place to stop, so let's do it.